Every week, most of us spend 40 or 60, maybe 80 hours doing traditional jobs. After dedicating so much of our time to work, we get a paycheck, validation for all that effort. But psychologically, it isn't all about the money. There's more that drives us to go 9 to 5. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Jabalani LaFall. On today's Central Standard, a look at the meaning of work with our resident psychologist, Dr. Bruce Leese. Why do we work? Are we searching for something? More than a job? More than a paycheck? How does our work become our calling? We'll also talk about the role that the modern-day office job plays in personal relationships and friendships, sometimes even marriages. That's all ahead on Central Standard after this hour's news. So you meet someone at a party or a reception. Hi, I'm Brian, and you are? Bruce, nice to meet you. And you know the next question, right? The next question is, and what do you do? In other words, what do you do for work? Why do we ask that? Why that? Why does work so define us? Well, at least some of us. Maybe not all of us. And why not all of us? What makes some people inclined to walk out of the office door at 5 o'clock on their last day and every day and not look back, while others fail at vacationing and then at retirement, maybe again and again? Good morning, Kansas City. This is Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, filling in for Jabalani LaFall, and we are talking today about why we work. A deeper, more difficult question than it at first appears, with our regular ambassador from the world of psychology, Dr. Bruce Leese. He joins us now. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, Brian. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to be here with you. So what are the reasons people work? And why do they say they work? And then why do they really work?
I think the most unfortunate reason why we all have to work is so that we can pay the bills. It's just not terribly inspiring to go to work so that we can do something else. So that's the main reason. But fortunately, there are lots of other reasons to work. We develop good relationships or unfortunately sometimes bad relationships. We have opportunities for all kinds of personal and professional growth. And sometimes it's even the work itself. That's optimal. That's ideal.
So people generally, though, I mean, a big part of why people work is obviously to make a living. Is that a satisfying reason to work?
You know, I've listened to a lot of people's thoughts on this, and I have decided it is a satisfying thing. The security of knowing that you can, if you have an illness, you can get it taken care of, that there'll be bread on the table, that there'll be shelter when you get home, and you'll have a transportation. Those are all good reasons to work. So I don't want to completely devalue the importance of making money and having benefits and health benefits, retirement. Those are very important.
So money can't buy happiness, but it doesn't hurt.
You know, there's a great research on that. Having not enough money to live really causes a great deal of unhappiness. But having way, way, way more money than you need never provides happiness. Money doesn't buy you love or happiness when you have enough.
Well, let's talk a little about that question that the scene at the party kind of raises, which is the connection between our work and our identity. You know, it is the first thing we ask people when after we know their name. The next thing we seem to want to know is what they do for a living. Why is that? Why is the job so connected with who we are?
There are lots of reasons. Probably the most obvious, I hate to state the most obvious, but it is the most obvious, that we spend so much time at work. Most people do not spend 8 hours or more doing any one thing or in any one activity, even in their intimate relationships. Most people don't do that more than 8 hours a day.
You see your coworkers more than you see your family.
And some people prefer that, unfortunately.
Yeah. So how does that shape us then? If we are spending so much time at our job that it's actually how we think about who we are, what implications does that then have for the rest of our lives?
You know, it's unfortunate that some of the implications are terribly negative, especially in a weak economic environment. We do so define ourselves by what we do that if it's yanked away because of problems with the economy, it's really a terrible struggle. Also, if we don't like what we're doing, some people refer to being inadequately or unhappily employed. Some people call that underemployment. If you're not doing what you want to do, it has more of a massive effect. There are so many things we can switch around and shift and change in our lives, but once we're in a job, it's kind of hard to get out of it. So if that brings an identity we don't like, that can be really traumatic for people.
Right. So if jobs were actually less stable, they might have less of an impact on our identity.
Yeah. If the expectation was that once a month, once a year, we'd move to the next job and somebody would take our place, if it was ever shifting, it wouldn't be part of our identity. But it's. Most people think of it as the most important thing they do after they take care of their families. And some people claim that their families are more important when they aren't. Their identity is really what they do for a living.
So what's the difference between a job and a career, I mean, as it relates to this?
Well, a job is really something you do for some kind of reimbursement, some kind of material benefit, salary, wages, benefits, health insurance, et cetera. That's what a job is. Whereas a career or a vocation it's serially working in various jobs for a lot of people. But there's a theme. There's a purpose. There's an understanding. What a person's more likely to have the identity of their career than the identity of the job they're working. You'll hear a lot of people say, that's just my job.
Right.
That's not who I am.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate. When somebody identifies a career for themselves, that's when they say, that's who I am.
Interesting. So, this makes me think, and of course, listeners to KCUR will know that I'm actually a Presbyterian minister in real life. So one of the things that I find interesting here is there's almost a sort of theological aspect to that. And I think of the way we use the word vocation. The word vocation comes from the Greek word that means calling, which sounds religious. But we use the word vocation, to talk about our career. Where does this idea come from that there is work that we are, sort of meant to do, made to do, called to do?
Well, we all have our own individual value systems, even if we associate those with bigger group value systems. But each and every one of us has kind of a fingerprint. That's our value system, and especially as it relates to work, is unique. And ideally, what we'll do is we'll find something that meets our unique needs and value system. I like that term calling. They actually started using it in academic psychology 3 years ago. You can find in psychology journals references to a calling. One author described a calling as correlating with favorable work outcomes, like job satisfaction. So you feel satisfied. That's part of a calling, that there's a commitment to it. You really feel committed to it. But Brian, this is the one that made me smile as you were talking. Anything that has to do with transcendent summons. Now, transcendent doesn't have to be religious, spiritual, or related to God. Transcendent means beyond oneself. So if it calls, my calling could just be something that's bigger than me, something that I might not even understand. It just brings me meaning because of it's bigger than me, beyond me.
It occurs to me, Bruce, that when we talk that way about jobs, that we run the risk of sort of becoming unduly focused on sort of white collar jobs, if I can put it that way. That is there a division here between those who feel that their job is their calling and those who you talk about their job as a calling, and they'd sort of laugh at you and say, "No, I'm not. I don't know. Checking groceries at the grocery store is my calling, or maybe they are. I mean, do we see a division here? Is there a danger in separating this as sort of a class issue?"
I wonder if you're wondering why I'm smiling from ear to ear. I love this question. I hadn't even anticipated it. My calling, my career has clearly been as a psychologist, as an educator. And in the last 10 years, I don't know why, but I opened a boat shop, and it's not a white-collar job. I feel so at home crawling underneath boats, sanding bottoms down and applying fiberglass. And some might say, well, you know, you don't have to do that. Well, once you start a business and you paid all that money, you got to do it. And I have to be there, and I love being there, and it feels like it's part of me. And so it is not a white-collar job. It is simply an experience that I love to do, and it kind of shocks me that people will pay for it. You know, working with my hands, which I do from Friday through late Sunday night, it just feels like who I am and who I was meant to be. So it is not white collar versus blue collar, and it's not certainly the salary doesn't matter. It's just what makes your blood flow.
Yeah. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking today with Dr. Bruce Leese about work and the meaning of work and the psychological significance of work. Kansas City, why do you work? Tell us about a significant decision you've made about your work or career and the impact that it has had on you. Or just tell us why. Tell us what gets you up and to the office or to your workplace every day. Call us at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Bruce Leese, we talk a lot about work. We've talked about it as part of our identity. We've only just touched on why people do it. And there's a phrase that's out there sometimes. Maybe you've heard this. Do what you love, love what you do.
Actually, Steve Jobs probably popularized that when he gave the address, the graduation address at Stanford University prior to his death, his unfortunate and untimely death from cancer a couple of years back. But that's what he said, do what you love, which is idealistic. Not everybody can just flip a switch and shift from what they're doing now.
If you're having trouble reaching us by telephone, please send us an email instead. We may be having some difficulties at the moment. We'll let you know when that's fixed. centralstandard@kcur.org. Is it really important for a job to be loved? I mean, do you need to love what you do? Can't it just be the thing that you do for 8 hours to make money?
It can be, and there's no shame in that, and that's certainly not a disaster. I believe that just being comfortable in one's own skin and in one's own daily experience is enough. There are enough people who are in pain because they're not doing what they want to do. I think there's no such thing as a mundane job. It's how you feel in it, and feeling just okay is just – it's okay.
So, I mean – it is okay, though? I mean, is feeling just okay about your job really okay, or is there a long-term sort of consequence to not loving your work?
Well, this is where the psychology part fits in. I argue at any opportunity that our own satisfaction, happiness, joy, fulfillment comes more from how we think and what we believe and how we process information than our environment around us. So there are different facets of what makes a job satisfying. One facet is the work itself, as I said earlier. Another is the compensation. Another is the opportunities to learn and to grow and to advance, opportunities for relationships. So if I don't like the job I'm doing, or if I don't like my supervisor, all is not lost. There are other ways to enjoy. It's not a black and white thing, and it's not caused by the environment. If I'm sitting at my desk thinking bad thoughts about my job, I'm making myself miserable. I could be grateful for any of the valuable things that a job can bring. It's multidimensional, multifactorial, multi-stuff, the reasons why people are happy or unhappy.
So why are they unhappy? Why do some people hate their job?
Seeking a job, finding a potential job, applying for the job, interviewing for the job, is a lot like falling in love. There's the obvious good stuff about falling in love, and there's also some dangers in falling in love. A lot of people like meeting someone new that they find very attractive. they don't really think it out. Why are people unhappy in the jobs? There are lots of people who think, I'm going to love this job. Or they'll tell the interviewer, this is me. I can do this. Your company looks great. It looks awesome. And they're not really thinking of the implications of what they've signed up to do. They may get a job in marketing in a major corporation, and the job is really it's really preparing mailings. That's marketing.
Right.
When in fact they really wanted to be the creative director at an ad aid, at a very, very big hopping ad agency. So they, we just like when we fall in love, we tell ourselves lies, and then we find ourselves in situations that we weren't expecting. That's what happens sometimes at work. You think you're going to love it, and once you get down to the nitty gritty, you hadn't thought it out well enough. You don't realize until then you didn't really love it. You weren't going to love it.
There's a fair amount of research, right? Some technical research on what contributes to job satisfaction and what doesn't. Can we learn anything from that? Are there ways that I could like my job? Not my job. I love my job. But ways that a person could like his or her job more?
One of the most important areas of research in psychology has to do with the fit between one's personality and the environment that they work in. If you are, for example, a highly artistic person and creative and you don't like constricted boundaries set around you, you'll be very unhappy in a conventional atmosphere or environment where you're expected to produce a certain number of widgets per hour. There's nothing wrong with producing widgets per hour, but if your personality type is more creative and you don't want to be bound by any rules or requirements, you can get very frustrated. It works the other way too. If you really want to know what the rules are in your company and you want to know what you're supposed to be doing and you don't want to be left with an ambiguous situation, it would really be problematic to find yourself in a more artistic, do your own thing environment.
What if you don't feel like you know? I mean, I think we're familiar with some of the popular culture books, the What Color Is Your Parachute kind of books. I mean, is that a place people should turn? Or is there some other way to know what it is that you will find fulfilling and satisfying?
Every time I do one of these shows, I go through the popular literature. I try to read some stuff and listen to books on tape and talk to people. That stuff is really valuable. I just started a book and I thought, oh, this is really boring. But I stayed with it and it was fascinating. So I think it's important to use, you said, why, how do you know? Using external references is a great way to proceed. What Color Is Your Parachute is a very, very good way to proceed if you're not sure who you are and what you want to do. Asking people how they view you, what do you think I'm cut out for, is really a fascinating way to proceed.
We'd love to hear from our listeners, but we're going to have to hear from you electronically because our phones aren't working right at the moment. But we do want to hear from you at centralstandard@kcur.org. You can also post on our Facebook page, the KCUR Facebook page. Tell us why you love what you do. And if something is more than a job to you, what is it? What's the more that it is? Facebook, or you can tweet at us too, @KCURCST. Or, of course, once again, that email address, centralstandard@kcur.org. So can doing work you love, Bruce, really make you feel better, make you a stronger person, make you more successful in other areas of your life? Does it have that kind of payoff?
Oh, yeah. Let's look at the opposite situation where somebody hates what they do and they come home exhausted and miserable and they kick the dog and they're mean to their kids and grumpy at their spouse. I mean, that's... You have that end of the continuum, and then at the other end, I get excited after a good day's work, and if I encounter a friend, I want to tell the story about the day, what happened today, and what made it interesting. So the answer to that question is absolutely, it's worth pursuing something that has great meaning to you.
So the meaning that let's actually. Consider an email here from Francie. Francie writes, I was forced into early retirement by vision loss. After a couple of good years pursuing enjoyable activities, I found some dissatisfaction with not being a productive member of society. That's Francie's words. Supporting myself is a big part of my self-esteem. I'm now a student seeking certification as a substance abuse counselor in order to give back and find more satisfaction in living my life. Bruce, is that a typical story, a good story that Francis?
Oh, it's a great story. I hate the thought of people who want work being unemployed, laid off, disabled. I think about all the veterans coming home from our wars and just not being able to go back to what they love because of their losses. And there's such a terrible downside to that. But there is also a potential silver lining in that cloud, and that's that it demands a certain level of creativity. So I don't know if Francie ever thought before that she would be a substance abuse counselor. I don't know if she ever would have contemplated it. It's interesting. If we don't take risks, we're so likely to find ourselves stagnant in what we're doing. So the pursuit of something extraordinary may require that kind of emergency or that kind of crisis, like Francie was describing from her vision loss.
Yeah. She also, you know, in addition to finding a work that she will find satisfying, she part of that is she has gone to school.
Right.
A student is sort of a traditional alternative to working. Is it itself a form of calling, a form of vocation?
I teach at a school. I teach at KU. It is work when you take it on. Well, it doesn't pay, but it has all the other characteristics of work. There are potential relationships at school. There's opportunities for advancement at school. There's opportunities for personal growth at school. And hopefully the intrinsic nature of study is great. So I would say school done well equals work. And I often tell people that feel lost in where they are in their lives, take courses, find something, go to community, seek something that makes you think and makes you change gears for a moment.
Right. It actually might trigger the reflection that leads you to the thing that you love.
Yes, it will. And it's unfortunate when, for some people, that's not even possible.
Yeah. We had another email here from Daniel. He sent us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org, and you can too. Daniel wrote, "I'm good at computers and it pays better than manual labor, but I'm happier now that I'm my own boss instead of working for a company. I do wish finding healthcare was easier though." A couple of good points in there, right, Bruce?
Oh boy. I besides finding crawling under boats and getting fiberglass in my face while I said, and besides finding that as a joy, somehow I found my way into the computer world. And that's another, these are not necessarily white or blue collar jobs. They can start out as hobbies. Actually, I think that's the best way to start out, to find your dream, to figure out your calling, is to look at your hobbies. And I don't know if Daniel played around on computers and said, boy, it'd be cool if I could make some money on this. But that's a really good way to shift a career focus towards one that might be preferable to somebody.
Yeah, I guess I wonder, sometimes choosing the job that actually is less profitable might end up being the better choice for someone, right?
Oh, the day I start making money on crawling under boats, I'll let you know. But I hadn't thought about a formula for finding one's dream job or calling. I hadn't thought of an actual formula, and I don't have one now. But thinking about it, I would say that if there's anything in the world you do where you just lose track of time because it's so engaging and so much fun and so fulfilling, if there's anything, let's just say it needs to be legal. Not hopefully, but it needs to be legal. But if you find something that gives you that kind of flow, that kind of enrichment, fulfillment, maybe that's what you ought to be thinking about doing.
Yeah. I mean, how do you know when, though? How do you know when to take the big risk to leave security behind in order to find this satisfaction?
I'm glad you put it that way, because it shouldn't be that big risk. That's the big mistake people make. Like falling in love, many people don't judge well the potential costs and benefits of that particular risk. If I were merely a professor at KU and I said, boy, I love boats, and I said, walked to my boss's office and said goodbye, and then walked out and started, put up a sign for I want to fix boats, First of all, I'm in for some surprises, no matter how I go about that. So a shift like that, risks like that bring with it big surprises. Some of them aren't pretty surprises. And those will wear on you like your old job did. And then suddenly you cut your leg and you remember, oh, I don't have health insurance anymore. So I advise people to not take gigantic risks in their career. With an eight-hour day, there is time left over with weekends and evenings to do stuff and figure out, do I really love this? To talk to people who do it for a living, etc. So good question, Brian. I'd say do not take a giant leap. It's not sensible. The little leaps are the ones that are the most important ones.
Yeah. We've got another email jumping back to a conversation we were having a moment ago. John writes, I'm so glad you brought up the white-collar, blue-collar division. My father was a bricklayer all his life, obviously blue-collar, and it was absolutely his calling. He defined himself as and was very proud to be a brick mason. As for me, I teach, and I'm pursuing a career in developing educational materials. It's true that work brings more than a paycheck. So what do you think, Bruce?
Having been a bricklayer when I was in my first year of college, a mason, an apprentice, I remember the work well to this day. And the instant gratification of seeing the beauty of your job done is very fulfilling. If you're fortunate, the people you're working with are. That was something that wasn't the case when I was in high school, college, my first year of college. If you do it and you feel that sense of flow where time just flies by and you're not bored and you're not restless and you don't wish that you didn't have to go to work or come home, then you've probably discovered it. So
we're going to take a quick break, but don't worry. Our work hour will continue the full hour here at KCUR. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about unemployment and underemployment and the implications of that on work in our mind and its meaning psychologically for us. We'll talk about work and money as well as about relationships with friends and coworkers, sometimes even future spouses. Kansas City, why do you work? Tell us about it. Tell us why you're in a job you love or why you're in a job you don't love. Email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. You can also post on KCUR's Facebook page. We're also on Twitter @KCURCST. More with Dr. Bruce Leese when we return. I'm Brian Ellison in for Jabalani LaFall. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison filling in today for Jabalani LaFall. On today's show, we're talking about the meaning of work. We'd love to hear from you what the meaning of work is for you. Why do you work? Why do you do what you do? Do you love it? If so, why? Call us at don't call us yet. We're still working on the phone lines, but email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. You can also post on KCUR's Facebook page or tweet @KCURCST. So Bruce Leese is with us. He's our resident psychologist, Dr. Bruce Leese. And we were talking about work and particularly about work and money. Let's spend a few minutes talking about this because way back at the top of the hour, you said that let's not negate one reason people work is because they need to make a living, because it provides security and benefits for their family. I wonder, does one's satisfaction with the job increase the less you feel like you have to be doing it? That is, if you don't need the money so much, do you enjoy your job more?
I think that anxiety caused by financial problems, that kind of anxiety can really create problems. I believe that even people who make millions per year, if that isn't enough to meet their voracious needs for material things and whatever else they're spending it on, I think that kind of financial insecurity can really make a person miserable in any job. If you're making millions and you feel like you have to embezzle to pay for your $20,000 a month mortgage, you're not going to be happy at work. You're going to be busy trying to figure out how you're going to pay the bills. And if you make minimum wage, I believe it's $7.25 an hour, that is not enough to live on. And so another form of those platinum handcuffs that are often referenced, they keep you in your job with material things, is health insurance. I wonder what will happen if we have some kind of health insurance for all, as I guess we're supposed to have. Mm-hmm. I think it'll free a lot of people up. I think a lot of people stay at work because they get benefits like that.
So. Right. And so having to not worry about whether you'll have those benefits would improve one's satisfaction with their work.
Or at least give them the sense that they have the freedom to move somewhere else without losing benefits.
So in your experience as a psychologist, Bruce, do you find that it's more important for people to, if I can put it this way, eat well or sleep well? Is it more important that they have their material needs met securely, or is it more important that they be happy?
Oh, definitely the latter. I see a perfect cross section of society in my practice as a psychologist. A perfect cross section from people who have been homeless to people who have really more money than they know what to do with. And happiness comes from within, not to sound trite. And finding that happiness is a lot like finding is the same as finding happiness in one's job or career.
We have a comment here from Ricky, a short comment. She just says, my bliss and calling comes from volunteering. So work, it is work, but it's work that you're not paid for.
This morning came from my volunteer job before I came over here. I have, I think, three distinct volunteer jobs that I do on a regular basis. And volunteering opens some amazing doors. Today I came from a planning commission meeting in Douglas County. And after doing that for a year, I wanted to be a planner. I wanted to go back to school and be a planner. So the joy I get from that is just as important to me in some ways. And when I'm finished with my term, I'll be seeking something else. Volunteerism is an extraordinarily good way of finding your calling and even adding callings to your callings.
Yeah. There was an article in the Atlantic Monthly last year. It was the headline was actually very telling. It was called "Squeezed Dry: Why Americans Work So Hard But Feel So Poor." And the article sort of explored a variety of reasons for that, but one of the things is that the basic necessities are not getting cheaper in life. So even though there's a lot of consumer prices that are getting lower, basic necessities, things everyone needs, aren't, but people aren't making significantly more money. That came down to a financial reason. Does that accord with your experience psychologically for why people are less satisfied and feel more poor?
I think one of the problems contributing to people's sense that they don't have enough is that we're always told through advertising and through all different media that there's more. You could have more. You know, I'm an iPhone guy. I understand there's a new iPhone coming out, and today there are a bunch of people suddenly feeling poor because they don't have the $600 for the new iPhone. So
right, but they didn't feel poor before it came out.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I have enough money to live. Oh man, I don't have enough money to live anymore because I can't afford that iPhone. But there are people who really don't make enough money to feel secure, who do worry about which bill they're going to pay today, and sometimes it's because of tragic health problems. So I don't want to minimize the importance of us keeping an eye on that and thinking about that.
Well, and let's invite listeners for whom that is an issue, for whom work would not be a vehicle to satisfaction, but rather a vehicle to survival and economic survival. Write us with your thoughts and with what work means to you. centralstandard@kcur.org. You can also post on the KCUR Facebook page. A lot of those folks are actually not employed today, Bruce. Unemployment rates have been very much in the news, part of the presidential campaign. Also, you hear talk about underemployment rates, that is, people who are maybe have a job but not enough to actually live on, not a living wage. What are the consequences psychologically of being unemployed or underemployed?
Think of unemployment as creating a psychological, chronic unemployment as creating a vicious cycle wherein losing one's job is a miserable shock if it was involuntary. And then Not having anything to do all day makes it worse. And then you're faced with the need for a lot of work. In order to find meaningful work, one must really work hard. I have a friend who made it an eight-hour-a-day job when he lost his job. So it's a vicious cycle where you know you've lost something important to you, a certain security and fulfillment. You find yourself bored, and then there's the shame, and then there's the huge demands placed on anyone looking for a job. It can be very miserable. It's important to find a support system. Oh, and then there's the isolation. Mm-hmm. I could go on and on. So unemployment can create can become chronic, ongoing, when people lose faith in their own ability to seek meaningful work. For some people, a minority, I will say, it's a relief. I've heard that often, but I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't claim that people who lose their jobs are happy. There are enough people who say, "Wow, it feels so much better waking up in the morning," but yeah. It doesn't fully feel better, just sort of.
I wonder. You said it's important to have a support system. You can't just snap your fingers and create a support system. What should a person who doesn't have that do? I mean, how can one get through a period of unemployment, not just financially, but psychologically?
You know, I've said this many times. Besides being a psychologist, where I talk to people because they come in to admit to problems, I also have this business, and people will come into our retail business. We'll just chat, you know. They'll say, "How long have you guys been here?" Blah blah. And people who are wise, who don't have support systems as they need, or who might be out of work, will mention, you know, "I don't have a job. Hey, if you guys are ever hiring, let me know." Or they'll talk about it, and we humans can sense when somebody is supportive of us. If somebody says to me at my shop, you know, "I lost my job," and I go, "Oh, that's tough," and I just go on to doing what I'm doing, they get the feeling I'm not going to be very supportive. But if they say that to me and I say, "What happened?" and I ask them good questions, they're going to feel like suddenly there's a support out there. It's not somebody who can pay the bills. It's not somebody they go home with. But a support system can come from surprising places. Volunteering is a great way to find support for yourself if you're unemployed.
I've heard of people who are unemployed sort of getting up every morning, putting on their work outfit, putting on the suit, putting on the shirt and tie, going to maybe it's a coffee shop, maybe it's somewhere that becomes like an office to keep them in that sort of mental place. Is that something you'd recommend?
Oh, big time, big mm-hmm. time. I had a friend describe in vivid details his workday, and he was unemployed, and it was impressive, and he's now in a very productive career that he's very excited about. And, you know, every time I see him, he talks about, "Oh, I'm taking this, you know, this class that's part of my job, and I'm getting certified to do the next level." And he never expected to do this for a living. And so you got to make it, like you said, get dressed for work. If you can do it at home, do it at home. If you're going to be pulled by the TV or whatever, don't do it at home.
Right.
Go to a coffee shop and get to work.
Well, here's another approach to finding yourself unemployed. We had an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. This is from Paige, who says, "After working as a planner for many years, the change with the economy took that away from me. At a crossroad, I decided to up and move away and open a bookstore. My fledgling startup has had its definite ups and downs, but I find myself far happier working 100-plus hours a week, barely making a living, than I ever was as a bureaucrat. It is my calling."
I love it. In addition to doing what Paige did, in addition to having a bookstore job as Paige does, I never understood until about 8 years ago that being an entrepreneur, as small as that is, a lemonade stand, being a true entrepreneur where you are trying a business and you're committed to that business and you're not going to just walk away from it, and it is growing. And being an entrepreneur is a second part of a job, or it's almost a second job. There's the work itself, and then there's you're the boss. So it's an extraordinary experience, and it doesn't have to be well-funded with the internet and social media and all that stuff. It can be started at home if it's well thought out and creative enough and you're willing to work hard enough.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR. We're streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking about the psychological meaning of work with our resident psychologist, Dr. Bruce Leese. You are welcome to email us with your questions or comments to centralstandard@kcur.org. You can also post comments at the KCUR Facebook page, where Blake says, "I work because I love what I do outside of it. My friends and family depend on the income I make, but I get enjoyment out of what I do for a living. I'm in IT, and I get to help people every day. Seeing the gratification on someone's face after doing my job is true satisfaction." So sometimes you can have both. You can have financial security and enjoy your job. And a nice email here from Gloria, too, at centralstandard@kcur.org. She says, "When I was 4, I started writing letters until the mailman made my mother make me stop. You see, I didn't know how to write, but I knew what I wanted to say. My career was basically problem solving, but it always included some aspect of writing. Now I write 3 columns basically on a regular basis. All 3 just fell into my lap, and I love it."
That's great. A lot of people dream of writing. They want to write a book. They want to write their autobiography.
Yeah, or a screenplay or a song.
Yeah, it's about the hardest work in the world, I think. I write. I have to write as part of my career, and it's not as easy as a lot of people think.
Yeah, it's most poorly paid. It's hard to get jobs. There's another piece of work that we haven't talked about yet, and that's something else that happens at work, and that's relationships. We noted that some people spend more time with their work than they do with their families or their friends or really any other part of their life. So it's not surprising that work becomes a place where we form relationships, peers, coworkers, friends. Sometimes even more than that, right, Bruce?
Yeah, you mentioned coworkers, peers, friends. The more public the business, the more different relationship potential, the more potential you have for relationships. So in a really open public business, I think people really enjoy working in coffee shops because they have their coworkers, they have the people who come in, I know somebody that says my barista, not the barista, but my barista at this coffee shop is. And
right.
I'm
smiling because you're starting to talk about me, I think. So and not only that, if I can add to that,
please,
at the coffee shop that I frequent most often, closest to my home, not only do I know all the baristas who I think of as sort of my coworkers in that place, even though I'm not actually on their payroll, but I know all the other the other customers who are doing something similar to what I am, spending a few hours several times a week getting work done there. And it does occur to me that there is something like an office environment, which I don't know if that's what Howard, the founder of Starbucks, was going for when he created that space, the third place, but it does seem to be a reality.
I can't believe I did this. I got so I felt so close to I don't call my barista because I just get plain old coffee. I don't get cappuccino and espresso, though I like it. But one day he told me his car was towed, and I'm sure I shocked him, but I took out my car keys and I said, "Follow me." I showed him where my car was. I gave him the keys and I said, "If you need to use my car, please do." I hope my wife isn't listening. No, she knows about this. But the relationships we make from the work we do, whether it's some kind of mental health care or repair shop or whatever, those relationships are meaningful to us and a big part of it. Of course, there are the people who get married because the two people they meet at work. Mm-hmm. And then there are the people who end up getting divorced because they've met somebody new at work. It's the web of relationships in a large workplace can be spectacularly big.
Right, which, of course, that's a very powerful good for better or for worse. That's a very powerful thing. Is it about more than just the amount of time one spends at work that causes that to happen, or does it get back to this sense that work is related to our identity?
Well, so much work involves problem solving, and when two people share a problem that they solve together, it can create a high that makes them feel like they are best friends, or they wish they got along better with their spouses or whatever. So not only is it that the time can work for or against a person at work. The amount of time they spend with others can work for or against them. So much of it depends on the quality of the relationship or the kind of work they do together. So I do believe that among the most painful experiences you can have in the course of normal life is having to work with somebody who is painful to be around. It could be because they have vastly different values. It could be that they broadcast those vastly different values, whether they're political, religious, social, economic values, or if they just they have a different way of viewing human beings. So you can get a lot of pain or a lot of pleasure from working close to others at work.
So we had an email with an example, perhaps, of the pain that you can have from Gertrude in Kansas City, who says she has a great job. She's a computer support person. Her supervisor's in a different state, so not breathing down her neck. But why does she hate it? The culture in the office where she is. And she actually feels like the coworkers are out to get her, says it's that they've complained about what she does on her lunch break. If she speaks too loud, they complain she has too many computers on her desk. What do you do if you, like Gertrude, find yourself in an environment where you don't feel supported by your coworkers and there's not really hope of reconciliation or repair? I mean, do you just sink further and further into despair about being at work?
I hope that everybody I've ever worked for, if they heard me say this, would say, yes, this is the kind of person Bruce is, what I'm about to say. I'm not thinking of Gertrude here. I'm thinking about everybody who experiences other people and feels bad about those relationships. I hope the first person that you would look at, as the expression goes, is the person in the mirror. Recently, my job at KU changed a little bit, and I didn't feel excited about the shift, and it was tempting to not be happy with, with the people who brought the shift to me. But I really, truly did think, well, why are you resisting this? Why don't you want to do this? It's really probably not that unreasonable. If you experience coworkers as being unpleasant, especially if you experience them all as being unpleasant, it's probably really wise to self-reflect and say, you know, this is at least 50% me. It's dangerous to attribute unhappiness to the environment because you can't really change the environment. So that's one thing I would suggest, self-reflection. Another thing I suggest always to great resistance is get away from the group and take an individual to lunch. Meet an individual for breakfast who you work with. Of the ones you don't like, pick the ones you like the most of the ones you don't like and say, you know, how do you like this job? Or just say, you know, I'm kind of struggling. Now, if you don't trust them, that's a whole different thing. But most people are surprised when they reach out to individuals.
Well, especially if you feel like it isn't going to – if it can't get much worse, you don't have anything to lose by taking that risk.
Exactly. And you can just ask questions too. You know, like what am, you can say, why do I tend to be the one who gets the negative attention around here? You know, do you have suggestions? What would you do differently? We are almost always at least half responsible for most of the emotional reactions we have.
I wonder then if one of the ways that some people don't deal with this is sort of just compartmentalizing their lives, saying that is work and this is home and my life and my family, this is who I am, and work, that's not going to be part of who I am, and they sort of make it as small a part of them as they can. Is that a desirable way to handle that?
No.
Can we really even do it? Can we make it a compartment of our lives?
No, I wouldn't advise it at all. This example flashed in my head, and it is not contrived. It's the real thing. I get my trash picked up. I live out in the country. I get my trash picked up every Thursday morning. I won't say the name of the man who picks up the can and dumps it into the truck, but I bring it out around the time they pull up. He always holds his hand out. He shakes my hand. He remembers my name. I know his name. And, I'm ready to turn around and walk back in the house, and he keeps talking. He doesn't compartmentalize. He doesn't think
he's the same person while he's working.
I'm sure he is. I even asked him, you know, where do you live? And we've talked about stuff now. And to try by compartmentalizing, what you're doing is you're admitting defeat. Mm. You're saying this is terrible, and I'm just going to shut it down when I leave here. And that doesn't serve a good function.
Now, but isn't there the flip side to that? I mean, isn't there a danger of too closely integrating work and the rest of your life such that you basically are always working?
The best thing to do is to use the word is to integrate well all the things you do in your life, all the things we do in our lives, whether it's hobbies or our spiritual activities or our vocation or our avocation, which is recreational. It's important to have balance. As corny as it sounds, it's important to have balance. And so work should never be everything. It should be part of everything.
What's the secret for you, Bruce, in the time that we have left to maintaining that balance? You've already said you between volunteering, between teaching, between the work you do for money and the work you do for love, how do you balance it all?
To be very concrete, my wife and I run the business together. I always, at least 5 to 7 days a week, I make dinner. I'm the one who makes dinner. My wife cleans up afterwards. So we spend a lot of time together. We talk a lot about the business. We talk a lot about the other things I do and the other things she does. So that we have a really spectacular relationship. The other thing is gratitude. Having gratitude for everything afforded us is a really good way of getting balance.
Finding ways to express that gratitude, too.
That's right.
Well, that's Dr. Bruce Leese, our resident psychologist. As you hear, he teaches at KU. He works at Kansas City Sailing, and he does all sorts of exciting things. So if you want to know more about him, you can visit our website. Bruce, it's always good to have you with us.
It is always my pleasure. Thank you so much.
We invite you to listen tomorrow for a talk about Tibetan Buddhist culture and some pretty exciting guests. Our show is produced by Tamika Weatherspoon. Up to Date is coming up next. Today, a talk with Paterno. About Paterno, the new book by Joe Posnanski, and the highly debated biography that it is. I'm Brian Ellison. I'm in for Jabalani LaFall. Tune in tomorrow. This is Central Standard, and enjoy your day.